Okay, so welcome everyone. Today is the session on basic Buddhism. So no complaints about it being basic because this is the basic session. But basic as it is, as they say, the basics, going over the basics again and again, in the end turns out to be the whole of the holy life, the whole of the practice which leads to freedom from suffering. So really it doesn't matter whether we've heard the things being said again and again, because as you'll see as I'm talking here, as I explain the topic of today's talk, it's not about what you hear or what you think, it's about what you do and what you practice. And the practice of Buddhism is a practice of simplifying, of calming the mind, keeping the mind from making more of things than they actually are, coming to see things simply as phenomenological realities, things which exist and have a real existence, and staying out of the realm of conceptuality. So the topic of today's talk is on what it means to dwell in the Dhamma, to live by the Dhamma. And this is a subject explained by the Buddha in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of Fives, in what is called the Dhammavihari Sutta, which is a sutta on what it means to live by the Dhamma. Dhamma vihari. Vihari is one who lives. Dhamma is the truth or reality, or according to the teaching, according to the, you could even say the doctrine of the Lord Buddha, but it really just means reality or truth. And so it happened that at that time a certain bhikkhu, a certain monk, came up to the Blessed One and paid respect to him, and sitting to one side asked the Lord Buddha that as he had heard it said that there was such a thing as a dhamma vihari. He heard people saying this word dhamma vihari, one who lives by the Dhamma. So he says he's heard this said, so in how is it that one can be called a dhamma vihari, one who lives by the Dhamma? Why would one, what would it take to be known as one who lives by the Dhamma? And so this is the explanation that the Lord Buddha gave. And the Lord Buddha's method of answering questions is fourfold. As he explained himself, he doesn't always answer a question with a direct answer. Sometimes he does answer a question with a direct answer. Other times he would answer a question by explaining something else first, not explaining the exact, not giving a direct answer, but explaining something else. Because sometimes the question, it was clear that the person couldn't understand a direct answer and was possibly asking the wrong question. Or at the very least, it required some background, because if the Lord Buddha gave a direct answer, the person listening wouldn't understand the frame of reference. So first explaining something else. Then there is the method of the Lord Buddha of answering a question with a question. So sometimes someone would ask a question and it really didn't have an answer, so then you have to ask them, well, you know, what do you mean by that? Or don't you see that such and such and such? So replying to show the person that their question was really problematic. And before, just not answering the question. So there were cases where the Lord Buddha would just refuse to answer, for instance, when asked, is there a self? And often it's not because he didn't know the, of course it wasn't because he didn't know the answer, or because there wasn't an answer. It's because answering wouldn't have helped the person who was listening. Now in this case, the Lord Buddha answered the question by first explaining something else. Because in order to explain what is one who lives by the Dhamma, he had to explain different types of people who live in different types of way in regards to the Dhamma, to show which ones are and are not those who live by the Dhamma. And this is, of course, very useful for us as Buddhists or as people who are interested in Buddhism, to come to understand not only what is the teaching of the Lord Buddha, but how do we relate to it? What do we do with it? And so he starts out by saying, first of all, there's a certain type of person who studies all of the Lord Buddha's teachings. And this, of course, many of us have done. We've studied the suttas, we've studied the poems and the verses, we've studied the stories, we've studied the pithy sayings, the psalms, and so on. We have many different categories of teachings that the Lord Buddha gave. The past life stories, as I teach on teaching on Sundays, I'm telling stories of the Buddha's past lives, studying all of the various aspects of the Lord Buddha's teaching. And having studied, having become totally full and complete in terms of study of the Dhamma, such a person sits around and does nothing. Divasang atinamiti, lets the days go by. Rinchati patisalanang, he throws aside or gives up a quiet place or his solitude. So having studied, they sit around and talk about it, or doesn't think to do anything, doesn't think to go off into a quiet place and try to understand or try to bring to fulfillment the Buddha's teaching, is content in his or her learning. So someone who has studied a lot and says, yep, I am now one who understands the Buddha's teaching. And this was, I think this is still common among Buddhists, both monastic and otherwise. I've heard even it said that you can be considered a Buddha simply because of your learning. And this is by using the word Buddha. Buddha can mean just one who has studied, one who is intelligent, one who has studied a lot could be considered a Buddha. So people understand that could possibly be enough. Well, the Buddha said here, this sort of person is not one who lives by the Dhamma. He said, this is one who has studied a lot. Parayati bahulo, one who is full of learning. No dhamma vihari, no means no, not. Not a dhamma vihari, not one who dwells by the Dhamma. So we have there's this great story in the Buddha's time of such a person as this. A person who studied and because of his study thought he was somehow special, somehow had done enough, somehow had done his job in the Buddha's teaching. His name was Tuccapotila. It's a very famous story among early Buddhists, Theravada Buddhists. And the story goes, there was this guy who studied the whole of the Buddha's teaching. Now the Buddha's teaching, as we know it in early Buddhism, takes up a whole bookshelf. So if you think of the Bible, and then you fill a whole bookshelf up with Bibles, then you have about the size of the Buddha's teaching. In the Thai version, there's 45 textbook-sized volumes, something like one for each year that the Lord Buddha taught. Not exactly, but that's what it looks like. The Buddha taught for 45 years, and there's 45 volumes in the Thai edition. And there were people, and there are people even today, very few, who have memorized or can pull any part of the Buddha's teaching out and explain and recite it, and memorize it by heart. And so this monk was one of those people. And he was really proud of this. He thought he had accomplished something in the Buddha's teaching. And as any of us who are familiar with the Buddha's teaching know this was a big mistake. And he was setting himself up for something, and indeed he was setting himself up for something pretty grave, a grave disappointment. And so having studied in this way, and even having gained followers and students who had great faith in him and his memorizational abilities, he thought to himself that he would go see the Buddha and get some sort of praise or recognition from the Lord Buddha. And his name was Potila, which means palm leaf or something like book, I think. It's, what do you call those little palm leaf manuscripts? I forget now. Anyway, it's something like the equivalent of a book in those times. And when he went to see the Buddha, the Lord Buddha said, oh, here comes Tuccha Potila. Tuccha meaning empty. And when Potila came to bow down to the Buddha, he said, oh, look at, empty book is bowing down now. And everything he did, the Buddha said, oh, there goes empty book. Oh, look, empty book is that. Until finally he got so ashamed that he left, and the Buddha said, oh, there goes empty book. And he was totally crestfallen or downhearted, how you say. He was totally depressed by this and upset by what the Lord Buddha had said. He couldn't understand why the Lord Buddha had not given him some sort of recognition as being a full book or one who had brought to fulfillment. Of course, Pariyatti means one who comes to fulfillment, and so they consider that by learning a lot they become full of the Buddha's teaching. And until he realized that it was because of his lack of practice. And so the story goes that he realized that he had this great ego inside because of his learning. And so he decided that he would go and find a teacher. And he went to this monastery. None of the monks would teach him because they saw that he was still subject to a very strong ego. And so the abbot sent him to practice with the vice abbot. The vice abbot sent him to practice with the next in line, and all the way down to the youngest monk. And the youngest monk wouldn't even teach him. And the youngest monk said, look, there's a 7-year-old novice playing down by the pool. You go and learn from him. He'll teach you. And you got to really give it to this guy because, you know, he had totally done away with his ego at this point, and he was really willing to learn, so much so that he actually went to the novice and asked the novice, please, will you be my teacher? And the novice is like, whoa, I'm a novice. You're the teacher. You're this great elder. And he said, forget about that. Please teach me. I know nothing about the actual teaching of the Lord Buddha. And he's still thinking about what the Lord Buddha had called him. And the novice looked at him. It turns out the novice was an enlightened being and was totally able to teach him. But the reason he was doing this was to really make sure that this guy wasn't going to give rise to further ego. And so he said to him, look, I'll teach you, but if I teach you, you have to do exactly what I say. And I've seen teachers use this before. It's really an interesting tool because you have to be careful when a teacher says this to you because you never know what they're going to get you to do afterwards. But he was like, oh yeah, sure, certainly this novice won't make me do anything totally embarrassing. Yeah, right. And so he said, fine, fine, just please teach me. I'll do whatever you say. You promise you won't talk back. Whatever I tell you to do, you'll do it. Yes, yes, I promise. Okay, very well, then we will run down into the lake. So the monk was like, what? Run down into the lake. He said, okay, and he started to take off his robes. He said, no, with all your robes on, run down into the lake. And so he ran down into the pond. Run, run, run. Yes, yes, so he ran. And he was out in the middle, treading water in the middle of the lake, sort of trying to keep afloat with all his robes on. Okay, come back out now. Run, run, run. And so he had him run back out. Okay, now go back in. Okay, come back out. Go back in. 3 or 4 times, you know, really giving the guy the run through. Really running him through the, how do you say, really testing him. Sorry, my English is pretty bad. I've been in Thailand for a long time. And so he's treading water out in the middle of the lake, and okay, the novice sees that, you know, okay, he's good to go now. Let's teach him. And he says to him, okay, suppose there were a anthill with 6 holes in it, and there's a lizard in the anthill. Most of us aren't familiar with this, but lizards apparently do go into anthills to eat the ants. What do you do to catch the lizard? And the monkey's thinking about it, and he says, "Well, you plug up five of the holes, and watch the sixth hole. When it comes out, catch the lizard." And the novice says, "Okay, then this is how I want you to practice. The six holes are the six senses: the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the heart. I want you to close up the five senses, the five external senses, not chasing after sights, sounds, smells, tastes, feelings. And I want you to watch the mind. And when you see the mind, I want you to catch it. And when you see the defilements, when you see your ego, I want you to catch it." And meditating right there, he became an arahant. He was totally free from, simply by watching his own heart. And so we see that really in the end, this is an excellent example of exactly what you need in Buddhism. The whole of the Buddha's teaching will not help you if you don't do this very simple thing of watching your own mind, watching your own heart. So this is the first thing that the Lord Buddha said is not what it means to be a Dhamma Vihari. Number two is someone who, once they've studied, they then teach. They're able to put into words and to explain and to basically teach to other people. And teaching, becoming very, very famous teachers, they then don't, as a result of their ego, as a result of their attachment, as a result of their lack of personal free time, they let the days go by. They don't think about finding a quiet place. They don't put out the effort needed to bring about quietude of mind or bring about wisdom. And this little Lord Buddha said, okay, so this is one who teaches a lot, full of teaching ability, not one who lives by the Dhamma. So teaching won't get you there either. Neither will learning, neither will teaching. And there's a story about this as well. This one's just as funny as the first one. There's a story about this monk who, he was a great teacher. Not only did he study, but he was also a wonderful teacher, and he could explain to people the whole of the path of the Lord Buddha, and actually all of his students became enlightened as a result. He was so good at teaching that everyone he taught was able to practice and become enlightened. And so he became very famous, and he had no time to practice for himself, and he himself was still unenlightened, was still an ordinary person. Until one day, one of his students, who happened to have magical thought-reading powers as well, was able to read his mind, thought to himself, I wonder, what about our teacher? You know, what sort of attainments has he attained? And he looked at, he realized our teacher's still an ordinary worldling, still someone who's full of attachments, full of defilements. And he thought, I can't let our teacher die this way. I have to help him. So he went in right when the teacher was very, very busy, and he said, teacher, please, would you be able to have time for a lesson? And this time, of course, the meaning of the lesson was something totally different. And the teacher said, I have no time. I'm too busy to give lessons now. I said, please come back later. I have no time for you. And so this student, he sat down, crossed his legs in the lotus position, and floated, rose up into the air, and said in a booming voice, you have no time for yourself. You're going to die an ordinary worldling. Why would I want a lesson from you? And he flew out through the window, flying through the air, using his magic powers. Thus have I heard. And the teacher was just crestfallen, totally upset, just like Tucha Potila. Suddenly he knew, he realized that he was totally negligent and totally going totally against the Buddha's teaching, and that he really, if he's going to be teaching others, it's like looking after the cows of another person. When you look after someone, the Buddha said, looking after someone else's cows, well, you don't get the milk, you don't get the butter, you don't get the products of the cow. All you get is the wages of a cow herder. if you're not the owner of the cows. In the same way, someone who studied a lot and even teaches, they're just looking after other people's cows. And so this guy, he didn't go to find a teacher, he just went off in the forest, because he already knew how to teach, he knew the way to go, and he knew how to practice. So he just went off into the forest and started meditating. And he meditated and meditated and couldn't get anywhere. He would walking and sitting, walking and sitting. And he got so upset. He got more and more upset as he practiced. Of course, I mean, this is the exact opposite way we should be practicing. Is out of stress, out of desire, out of need, out of this goal-setting mentality where we're not in the present moment. We're always like, am I there yet? Kind of in the future all the time. And with some kind of need, and it's creating more and more stress as we practice, forcing ourselves to be focused and so on, trying to force our minds to be the way we want them and so on. So he got totally stressed out and started crying. He just eventually broke down and started crying. Now, as it happened, because he was such a famous, this teacher was not famous only among humans, he was famous also among angels. And so as we recognize in Buddhism, there are many angels hanging around that we can't see. A lot of them are sort of living in forests and in nature and so on. And so here it turns out there was an angel living in this forest who knew about this teacher and thought, wow, I'll just practice exactly as this teacher does and I'll become enlightened as well, because this teacher is a very great teacher. So when the teacher walked, this angel would walk. When the teacher sat, this angel would sit and would try to figure out exactly what the teacher was doing and try to mimic that and hope to become enlightened. And so when this teacher sat down and started crying, this angel suddenly appeared in front of him and started crying as well. And the teacher said, why are you crying? What are you doing here and why are you crying? He said, I'm here following you. I'm crying because I saw you crying. I figured that must be the way to become enlightened. And the teacher's like, don't. And he wakes up. And that really, you know, brings him to his senses. And then he really starts practicing. He sees what an idiot he's been. And so he sits down and he really puts his heart into it. And he does become enlightened. So just another example of how even teaching won't get you out. This is number two. Number three. Where are we? Number three, there's the person who studies a lot and then chants it. Chants the Buddha's teaching. Have you ever heard of these people who try to become enlightened just by chanting? Or these people whose Buddhist practice is simply chanting? And there's a funny story I once heard a monk tell of this woman who everywhere she went, yeah, she would chant. And so when she was cooking, when she was washing dishes, she would chant. And this was a story he was telling in Singapore. And in Singapore, they chant Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha. It's the name of Avalokiteshvara, as far as I understand. It's Amitabha, or Amitabha, as they say. Fa means Buddha, I think. And right, also known as Avalokiteshvara is the Sanskrit word, I believe. And every day, she would chant thousands of times every day, and she wasn't getting anywhere, because it was just kind of a rote memorization, and her heart wasn't really in it. It was just kind of Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha. And her dedicated son, who saw that she was a very dedicated Buddhist, but not very wise, that perhaps he could help to explain things or show her something that she wasn't seeing. And so one day when she was deep in her trance and washing dishes, I think, and saying Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, he said, Mother, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Mother, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Mother, what? Why are you bothering me? And he said, Mother, if you get angry at me for calling your name three times, how angry do you think Amitabha will be when you chant his name thousands of times every day? And his mother realized that certainly this chanting that she was doing was not leading her anywhere with with all of this anger. And there's this monk went on, and someone asked him, so is chanting the name of the Buddha enough to become a good Buddhist? And he said, there is no Mahayana text. And this he was referring to the Mahayana. He said, there's no Mahayana text which says by chanting the name of the Buddha, by chanting Namo Amitabha, you can go to the Pure Land. There is no single text, he said. He said, there may be some later texts who try to say that. He said, that's not what the Mahayana texts say. What the texts say is that if you chant the name Namo Amitabha with a pure mind, you'll be born in the Pure Land. And then he said, and the same goes for if you chant Coca-Cola with a pure mind, you'll go to the Pure Land. And this was his teaching on that day. Yeah, so it's also common in Theravada Buddhism. This isn't trying to make fun of any specific tradition. There's many monks. I myself have got fairly good at chanting. I was asked to recite the monk's rules, which is something that not all monks can do. It takes about a half an hour to 40 minutes of constant chanting very, very quickly to get through it. There's 227 rules, and it takes a few months. Well, it took me 2 months to memorize them all. And then it takes about 40 minutes of just solid chanting to go through them all. And many monks can't do it. And, you know, this kind of thing can give you great ego, and I even know people who can chant them all but can't keep very many of them at all. So it really doesn't say much. It's just you've got a good memory. So this is number 3. But such a person, they chant, but of course they don't go off and find their... They can even get a lot of money this way. It's a good way to make your livelihood as monks, because lay people like to hear the chanting and so on. So, of course, it would be totally detrimental to any type of meditative lifestyle. Not the chanting itself, but getting caught up in it and going out and seeking out invitations and so on and getting support from people because of your ability to chant and so on. And number 4. So then there's a person who studies, who goes through all of the Buddhist teaching. And you'll notice one thing here is that there's nothing said about not learning. It's very clear that learning is a very good thing. I don't want this to be misunderstood. Many people think, learning, it's for bookish people. No, the Buddha was very clear that all people should study insofar as they're able. If you're not able, if you're old or you know, you feel like your memory's not so good. I get a lot of people, you know, I've even had people who are in their 80s and their 90s come and practice, and of course there's no need to give them all sorts of book study. It's not necessary, but it's a great thing, and it paves a broader path for you and for the people around you to sort of live your life by. There's certainly something good to be said about studying and listening, but it's not a substitute for practice. So number 4 here is a person who studies very, very well, and then they anuvitaketi, anuvichareti. Vitaka means they think about it. Vichara means they ponder it. So they're always going back to it, going over it, and vichara means they're thinking about it and wondering about it and trying to decide what is the truth of this and that. And this you get with people who study the Abhidhamma, at least in the Theravada school. I'm not too familiar with the Abhidharma of the Mahayana schools, but from what I've seen of it, it's pretty similar in the fact that it's pretty pretty scholastic. Vitaka means to go to the object. Vichara means to go around, move around in it. It's thinking about and thinking of and thinking about kind of thing. They're just two very common words. It just means thinking about and pondering over and mulling. You know, just sitting there and thinking all day. Thinking about the Dhamma, people who like to sit around and think about the Abhidhamma, people who like to think a lot. I can't think of a good story here, and I'm running out of time anyway, so I'll just skip through this one. I think it's clear that... No, I don't think it is clear. I mean, many people probably do just sit around and think about the Dhamma and think they appreciate it. I guess the best thing to say about this is it's not a substitute. It's easy to think it's a substitute when you think that, yes, I understand that everything is impermanent, I understand that it's suffering, that it's not under my control, and yet I'm not enlightened. And so you might think, well, maybe this is all there is to the Buddha teaching, maybe this is what it means to be enlightened, or it's easy to get kind of negligent or lazy, thinking that you've come to the top and not realizing that there is a very real enlightenment that can be found in the here and now, which has nothing to do with vitaka and vichara, with thinking and pondering, with mulling over the Dhamma. It comes from direct experience, and it's totally different. It's something that you just hits you like a lightning flash. Suddenly it's like impermanence. It's just like reality, because that's what it is. Reality is impermanence and suffering and uncontrollability. Sorry, suffering means unsatisfying. You see, because it's impermanent, there's no good to be found in it. My idea that there could be happiness in something external to me is wrong. And so you stop looking for happiness in external objects. So this is number four. Now what is number five? Number five is the Dhamma Vihari. And what does it mean to be a Dhamma Vihari? There are four factors. And so if you remember anything, remember these four. Number one, na tiva sang ati nameti. It doesn't let the days go by. This is number one in the Buddhist teaching. Don't let the days go by. Don't let the moment pass you by. Kano wo ma upachaka. Don't let the moment pass you by. This is the Buddhist teaching. It's in the Dhammapada. So when we hear this phrase, don't let the moment pass you by, you know where it came from. It's 25,000 years old. I don't know, maybe somebody else said it even before that. But it's in the Buddhist teaching, 2,500 years old. Don't let the moment pass you by. And this is key in Buddhist thinking, is that we practice now, we practice here. All of us sitting here, even listening to the Dhamma, we can practice. We can look and see and try to understand what it is that we're faced with. Look at our emotions, look at our thoughts, look at our responses to things. What's going on in our mind? Do we have a headache listening to all this funny stuff this monk is saying? Do we have a pain in the legs or in the back from sitting so long in the lotus position? Or so on. Do we feel happy listening to the Dhamma? Looking at all of these realities, we can take them as meditation objects. So this is number one, not letting the moment pass you by. Always here, always now. And not worrying about the past. I wasn't mindful before, big deal, it's gone. Be present here and now. Whatever you've done in the past, it's gone. Future is not here yet. This is how the Buddha said to have a good day. Don't go back to the past, don't worry about the future. How do you have a good day? Whatever comes up in the present moment, tata vipassati, see it clearly. Vipassana means to see clearly. Vipassati, sees it clearly. This is number one. Number two, na rinchati patisalanang, not throwing out, giving up quiet places. This is another big key that we often lose sight of in the Buddhist teaching. Is the Buddha taught us to find solitude. A lot of the good things that come from practicing meditation cannot be found amongst people and amongst society. Where often we like to sit around chatting or discussing or mulling. We can see that that's really only beneficial for the types of people mentioned above. It's not beneficial for one who wishes to live by the Dhamma. Living by the Dhamma is something you find for yourself. What a teacher can do for you is only give you the tools, show you the way. If you sit around looking at his finger while he points, it's really of no use. And so we try to at least find a place where there's nobody going to bother us. There may be people around, like sometimes in the park or in a monastery or so on, but in a place where we know we'll be able to sit and meditate and be by ourselves. Be inside of ourselves without having to deal with or worry about other people. This is considered to be quite important in the Buddhist teaching. It can be said that on a basic level, it's not essential. And the reason it's thought to be important here is because we're going to be talking about concentrated states of concentration. Now, if you're just looking to sort of understand life and live your life in a more peaceful way, even become enlightened, it's not entirely necessary. There's people who, just living their ordinary lives, because of the circumstances and the teaching that they had gained, they were able to, in their ordinary everyday lives, become enlightened by being mindful of the things which were presented to them. It's only to say that, first of all, for the fulfillment of the Buddhist teaching in terms of gaining magical powers and high states of concentration and super knowledges and so on, and for ease of becoming enlightened, for making it really easy and powerful and increasing the potential to become free from suffering, it's irreplaceable, or it's quite useful anyway to go off on one's own. This is number two. Number three is to gain, to work hard to gain these states of peace and calm. And this is the practice of tranquility meditation. So one who lives by the Dhamma is one who has calmed the mind, who has taken out of the mind the five hindrances, which are sensual desire, ill will, let's put it in easy English, liking, disliking, drowsiness, distraction, and doubt. These are the five hindrances, five things which obstruct one's progress, cloud the mind, keep one from feeling peaceful and calm, keep one from realizing the truth. And so learning to do away with these, in the meditation that I teach, we simply watch them. And as I've said before, we take away the fuel, so we just look directly at them. When we like something, we say to ourselves, liking, reminding ourselves of it and only it, and not going back to that which we like. If we don't like, saying disliking. If we feel drowsy, saying drowsy. Just coming clear about the reality of it, not letting ourselves go the next step, which is to say, oh, I'm drowsy, I should go to sleep, and so on. This is number three. When these five things are gone from our mind, liking, disliking, drowsiness, distraction, and doubt are gone from our mind, this is considered to be tranquility in the Buddhist teaching. The mind then is calm. These are the five things which keep the mind from being calm and tranquil, and keep one from seeing the truth, really. And that's number four is, and the wording in number four is kind of telling. It's that one gains wisdom, comes to know the meaning of the Dhamma, with wisdom, with higher wisdom, uttarincha. So it means the wisdom that we gain from practicing is on one level. What we're looking for is to gain a higher sort of wisdom, the wisdom which comes, of course, from seeing clearly or understanding the truth. So when we teach all these things about how to practice meditation and things which are good, things which are bad, this is a kind of wisdom to know what are good things and what are bad things. But it's on a whole other level, and this is uttarincha sapanyaya, with wisdom that is higher than that. Higher than the wisdom of simply book learning. So when we come to see, come to know fully or know clearly the meaning of the Buddhist teaching through practice, this makes one who lives by the Dhamma. And then the Lord Buddha said, well, now I've explained to you these five types of people. What is the person who just studies? What is the person who teaches? What is the person who chants? What is the person who thinks? And what is the person who lives by the Dhamma? And then he says, etani bhikkhu rukamulani. There, O monk, there are the roots of the tree, the foot of trees. Etani sunya karani. There are the empty buildings, empty dwelling places. Chayata bhikkhu, meditate bhikkhu, meditate, O monk. Mapa matata, don't you be negligent. Mapacha vipatisarino ahuvata, don't be sorry afterwards. Don't let yourself feel ashamed later on. Ayang wo amha kang anusasaniti, this is our teaching to you. And that was the Dhamma Vihari Sutta. There's two of them, and they go together in the Anguttara Nikaya. So that's my teaching for today. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to take them. Thank you for listening. Well, it can be confusing if you're not practicing. I suppose in a general sense it's confusing. I mean, I was kind of lucky to have kind of stumbled into a very specific path in a very traditional setting, so it was all very cut and dry for me. I think that's what is the word I'm looking for? I'm sorry, my English is terrible. Irreplaceable. Something like that. It's great to have this kind of invaluable. Yeah, that's probably what it was. It's invaluable. Yes, that was the word. When you have this traditional setting and a teacher who's just teaching you one path and you just follow that path and forget about all of the other ways. No, I'm from Canada, actually. That's the sad part. It should be perfect, but I've been living in Thailand for so long that it's terrible. I had to relearn English when I came back to the West. Yep, that's what happens. My Thai is really good. Yes, a question. Right. Yes. That's not a question yet. I spoke earlier about being caught up in only thinking of concepts of impermanence. Yes, I did. Lately, I have been through some bad losses and I've been trying to understand those concepts. Mm-hmm. But I think that I have been caught up in only constant thinking. Mm-hmm. What more can I do? Well, you can focus on the reality of it. I mean, this is the key distinction between looking at the. I first of all, I should say that mere concepts can be helpful. It can be helpful to think of these things as impermanent, suffering, and non-self. It's just not nearly enough. It's not going to free you from suffering. It's only on the level of thinking. What you can really do to overcome these things, I mean, if you watch some of my videos, it gives my sort of take on all of this. But when you focus on the reality of what you're confronted with right now, it takes your mind off of the losses, which are totally useless in your development on the spiritual life. That thinking about these things is not going to help you at all, because they're delusions which still exist in the mind. The idea that these things still exist, that I've lost something. Well, since it's not there and you're not experiencing it, it's only a feeling which arises in the mind. The reality is that you're feeling resentment, you're feeling suffering, you're feeling sadness. And this is reality. And this is what generally we ignore. We ignore the reality and we focus on something which doesn't really exist. And, I mean, I guess it seems kind of like you don't want to do that. You mean you want the thing back, right? But the reality is you're not going to get it back. And if it comes back or doesn't come back, it's a totally different thing, your spiritual development, and whether you're going to get the thing back or whether it's going to come to a place where you have the things you want. It doesn't mean that we should abandon trying to obtain the things which, you know, we feel are necessary or are going to, you know, would be good things to have. But it's totally on a different level from our spiritual life. And during the time that we're trying to get the things which we feel are necessary to live our lives, we have a level of spirituality to think about, and we have our spiritual life to think about. So all we're doing here is looking at what's going on in the meantime. Right? In the meantime, we've got this resentment, we've got this attachment, and all of this thinking that is going over and over and over again over just a thought, a concept of something which we think we lost. So we focus on those and we use them as our meditation. When we feel resentment or disliking, sadness, we say to ourselves, sadness, sadness. It's all the same mind state. It's based on an anger. Though we don't in English call it anger, it's based on a specific mind state, which is a disliking, dissatisfaction of an aversion to something, to the mind state. When we think about it, we don't want to think that. We don't want to remember that. We don't like the thought that we've lost something. And so we say, we give rise to this resentment, and we get all of these emotions. So in meditation, we just focus on the resentment and say to ourselves, disliking, disliking, sad, sad. Reminding ourselves of the reality of what's going on so that we forget about the illusions. We stop going back and creating these illusions that it's me, it's mine, and I lost it. Or we focus on the thinking so that the resentment doesn't come up. It's like breaking the loop and creating wholesome loops. Not letting our mind go to where it normally would and creating new. Some people choose to not think, to compartmentalize, and I get a sense that it is counter to a path to enlightenment, less or no suffering. Yeah, I'd agree. I think the general sort of an easy way to understand how I would explain Buddhism is that in ordinary discourse we talk about two different ways of approaching something, repressing it or releasing it, which in Buddhism we say following after it. So we say our ordinary way of dealing with things is to either repress them or to chase after them, to give them power. So in Buddhism all we're doing is giving up both of those and simply accepting or acknowledging is the term that we generally use, acknowledging things for what they are. So things like not thinking is of course repressing, and that's what you often get among people who are celibate. You've seen these cases of celibate monks or priests who then go and do bad things with little boys. And you can only guess that it's to do with some kind of perversion created by sexual repression. And our ordinary way of thinking how to deal with that is, well, you know, priests should be allowed to marry and have wives and have sexual intercourse. But of course there's a third way, and this is the way of simply accepting the feelings and so on. And this is just another example. And other people say, you know, when you feel angry, you should just let it out, right? This is because we only know of two ways to deal with things. When we're angry, we think better to let it out than repress it. Well, no, it's not. Letting it out is how you create bad karma. But there's another way, just accepting the anger and letting it be. Not accepting, it's acknowledging. Accepting is too much of a positive. You're not giving it any positive connotation. You're just not giving it any negative connotation. Nods. Smiles. One might be impatient with easing grief. I think it takes time to feel and not feel that pain. Well, all I can say to that is patience is indeed both very important and very difficult to practice. The Lord Buddha said, "Kanti paramang tapo titika." Patience is the highest form of austerity, better than any sort of austere practices, torturing yourself in any way. Simply torturing yourself by being patient, that's the worst torture, the best kind of torture, the highest form of torture, you could say. And boy, is it torturous, no? I suppose I have been caught up in the idea that I need to not want in order to not feel pain, though it seems very difficult to not enjoy or remember things once enjoyed or loved that are lost. Well, that's because there's desire, there's attachment to them. And it's very difficult to see that that leads to suffering. The Lord Buddha said, of course, there are three, we understand there to be three negative states of mind, which are greed, anger, and delusion. And anger is something that is very easy to see the disadvantages of, but it's something that changes very quickly. It's something that has, that is given great weight, or considered to be very, very bad by people in the world, but it's something that changes very quickly. Greed, on the other hand, is something that changes very slowly, goes away very slowly, but it's not easy to see the problem with. It's not considered to be a very bad thing by people in the world, and that's why we live in a world where consumerism and entertainment and pleasure is given such a high value, and yet happiness is still so very elusive and hard to find. And delusion, which feeds both of the other two, this sort of ignorance or ego and conceit and so on, is both given very little importance and very difficult to see as something that is bad, and it's also very slow to change. So it's the worst of the three. But this is the difference among the defilements. So most of us are pretty, most of us Buddhists are getting better at it, but mostly in people's hearts they think of ego and, you know, self as a very important thing, no? It's much harder than the others to see it as a bad thing. I've even met people, it's amazing how you see people in some societies who will just go out of their way to go to any extent to show you how great they are and tell you about how wonderful they are. It's something that you see, I don't see so often in the West, but something that I encountered quite a bit in the East. It's interesting how there are certain people who can just go to any lengths to make it clear to you how great they are. Anyway, the awakening does not mean that you can't feel desire, hurt, pain, or happiness, suffering, or sorrow. You can still feel all those, they just don't convince you, Ken Weber. Well, yeah, maybe I would disagree with him. I don't know that Ken Wilber is enlightened or not. But I've heard that kind of a view that all of those things. There's even one guy on the internet somewhere who claims that he has all of those things, and yet he's a perfectly enlightened being. So he must agree with this guy Ken Wilber. My teachers don't agree with that. Well, yeah, I'm not a non-dualist. Yeah, I mean, obviously there's different ideas on what makes an enlightened being. But I would say a person without anger, for instance, is better than a person with anger. A person without attachment is better than a person with attachments. It's considered to be a higher state. So I would say that a person that still has all those things, desire, hurt, pain, well, pain and happiness is clear that you have to still have. That's not a quality of mind. But sorrow and desire are negative states of mind, and those are done away with. Right. Well, it's easy to say. They're pretty sticky mind states, though. It's hard to imagine them passing through. Anyway, I suppose that's all just philosophy until we put it to the test. Well, except for the fact that desire is a holding on in and of itself, so. As soon as you say the word desire, if we're talking about the same thing, then it's impossible to say it's not sticky, because it's stickiness itself. That's what we call desire. Otherwise, we're not talking about desire, I don't think. Same with sorrow. Right, well, yeah, okay. Well, let's put it into practice and we'll see where it goes. Truth is singular. The truth is the truth. So if I'm wrong, I don't mind. The truth is not wrong. Is there a way to go after goals or things but maintain a state of enlightenment without ego? No. Not a full state of enlightenment. A full state of enlightenment has no goals. It's hopeless. Lord Buddha said, height of humanity is... well, it's a bunch of things that maybe are difficult to understand, but one of them is being hopeless. This is the height of humanity. And maybe I'll give a talk about it one day. But hopeless means having no hope. And why do you have no hope? Because you've done what needs to be done. Wusitang brahmacharing katang karaniyang. You've done what needs to be done. What would you hope for? What would you wish for? It's having graduated. So, but I suppose your question simply means... Well, it's an interesting question. I think a better question might be, can you practice Buddhism and still have goals? And I think yes, but by the time you become enlightened, you don't have any goals left, and you sort of just do because, like a rolling stone. In the tradition that I follow, it's persistent and constant. If it were discontinuous, yes, it would not be real enlightenment or real perfection. I can't see how it would be special in any way. Would a role to help others become enlightened? I don't quite understand. Helping others is good towards enlightenment, I think. Helping others is, the Buddha said, by helping others you help yourself. I think that's pretty clear that there's no difference. When you help others, you help yourself. When you help yourself, you help others. Would a role to aid others to become enlightened, would that be a role of an enlightened being? Yes, but not a desire to do so. This is the key, is there's no desire left. Otherwise, how could you be considered enlightened and teach people? And if you have a desire to help people, then everything you teach is about desire, right? It's tainting your teaching. But for sure, I mean, I think that's pretty clear, or else the Buddha wouldn't have taught. But that's qualified by the fact that he taught because he was invited to teach. and having been invited to teach, you went and taught as invited. It's a duality: be a hermit and enlightened, but never help others on their path to be enlightened, but imperfectly to be out with people teaching. Or be enlightened but imperfectly and be out with people teaching. Yeah, I think that's a duality I don't quite see. I think I'd agree with you that there should be no duality there, if that's what you're saying. But I don't see that a person who's enlightened necessarily has to go out and help people. I don't see it as a qualification for being enlightened. If someone comes to you and asks for your help and you say, no, go away, then it's pretty clear that that person's not enlightened. Well, who knows? Maybe they've got a special way of teaching. Maybe that's the best thing for you when they say that. But if someone's, you know, sitting there meditating and doesn't actively seek out students, I think it's in fact a sign of being unenlightened when people actively seek out students and try to teach and try to push their opinions on other people and so on. That's a sign that we're still playing with ego and so on. Well, I wonder if this was Buddha's intent, individual non-transmissive enlightenment. No, see, the Buddha had no intent left. He taught people what he had learned. He had no intentions left. So he taught people what he had learned, and we've used it for our benefit and for the benefit of other people. You know, it's just nature. It's the law of nature. So if you want to transmit it to others, you transmit it to others. If you don't want to, you don't. It's the law. It's just nature. My nature is different from other people's nature. Your nature is different from my nature. But we both have nature inside, and some of that nature is good, some of it is bad. And all we're trying to do is get rid of the bad nature. It may not be for everyone to teach, but that's no excuse to find a way to help others become enlightened in any small way they can. Well, that is kind of a value judgment, though. I mean, so when a person doesn't, they're doing something wrong? Seems very difficult, at least for me, to get over the idea of no desires. Yes, I know it's a difficult idea. That's why, but we're not looking in the realm of desire. We're in the realm of ideas. We're looking in the realm of practice. As you practice, it becomes clearer. Desires to want a good job, things, love, even the desire to be enlightened. I think you missed the first question period where I addressed that already. How can one achieve anything without desire to be or do? Well, let's go over it again then, shall we? Some desire is just semantics. It's not really desire. Desire, when we talk about it in a Buddhist sense, means an attachment to something or wanting something. The desire to become enlightened is not wanting to become enlightened. Yeah, no, that's okay. I'm not blaming you. I'm happy to explain it. The Buddha was also asked this question, and he explained it in his own way. But first, if I can explain it in my way. Is that we call it desire, but when we practice meditation, we're really doing it often more out of simply a realization which has really profoundly stirred us, that there's really something intrinsically wrong with the way we're living our lives and the way we're behaving and the way we're approaching reality. And so we're doing it not because we want something, but sort of as a necessity and because of a knowledge that it's right. And that's what it becomes later on. In the beginning, it can often be full of desires, aversions, worries and fears, being afraid that we're going to have to face these defilements that are inside of us, being totally paranoid or just incredibly worried about the future, that if we don't get rid of these things, they're going to cause us suffering. But as we practice on, it just becomes the right way, and there'd be no reason to do anything. But I mean, people say, well, why do we still meditate? You know, or why would an arahant still meditate? And well, what would you have them do? I mean, if there's nothing else to do, they just meditate. It's the right thing to do, being mindful and so on. How the Buddha answered this question, he said to the man who asked him, and he said, well, when you came to see me today, did you want to come to see me? Did you intend? You want to? You in that you intended to come to see me? And he said, yes, I wanted to. I intended to. And the Buddha said, well, and what about now, once you're here sitting with me, do you still want to come to see me? Do you still intend to come to see me? And he said, no, now that I've gotten here, I, of course, don't have that want, don't have that intention. And the Buddha said, in the same way, my monks, when they practice to become enlightened, in the beginning they want to become enlightened, they intend to become enlightened. And the way he used the words, he made it clear that it was only a semantics argument. The problem was a misunderstanding of the different meaning of the word chanda, which can mean desire, but can also mean intention. It can also just mean contentment. And when they realize enlightenment, the desire, the intention, the contentment with practicing disappears, or the intention to practice disappears, because they've realized their goal. So it's called desire in English, but it's not considered one of the defilements to want to practice, for instance. It's associated with right understanding? Yeah. Yeah, I think that's sort of the base of it, yes. You see, look at that person, they really like practicing, or boy, I really want to practice, or something. I agree that you could give rise to desire and aversion as a reason to practice meditation, but it's not what in the end leads us to enlightenment. Let's put it simply and say we're talking about desire for things, attachment or addiction to things. Is it in your particular practice to observe these states, whatever they may be? What states? Observe these states rather than reacting. Yes, observe, acknowledge. We have, as I mentioned before, we use this mantra, and the mantra is something which is a means of fixing the attention on the object and only the object. So a mantra would have been used in ancient India to focus on a concept. Well, here we use the mantra to focus our minds on the reality, and it creates a clear thought. I mean, normally we're thinking about the object anyway. When we see something, hear something, when we feel a desire, we start thinking about it anyway, like, how can I get it, and so on. All these thoughts going on in our mind, well, we clear that up and create just a single clear thought of what it is, and that's desire. So we say to ourselves, wanting, wanting, or desire, desire, however it appears most clearly to you. Certain paths use the observation of bodily sensation. Do you only use mantra? Yes, I observe the sensations, but I also use the mantra. The mantra is a means of fixing the mind on the bodily sensations. I know the sort of practices you're talking about, and no, I don't follow that path that you're talking about, that type of practice. I have a single practice, and I follow it. If you're interested in learning the way I practice, I teach. Hopefully, I'll be setting up interviews on Thursday. Okay, so I think that's a good session for today. And if you have any other questions, you're welcome to direct them to me on your own time. Okay, I'll be out of here now. You're welcome. See you all next time.